Great to have you with us on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and it's time for another book club meeting, the Larry Mueller Show Book Club. We're talking about the book today on the show titled When I'm Dead. And just a reminder, in the book club, we like to feature books written by Wisconsin authors and or books set in Wisconsin. And today we have both. And our author with us, Hannah Morrissey, writes the book, or has written the book we're talking about today. She writes the Black Harbor Suspense series, a couple of other books in that series, one Hello Transcriber, the other titled The Widowmaker. She grew up in a small, on a farm, actually, in northern Wisconsin. She now lives in Milwaukee with her husband. And it's great to have her with us today to talk about her book, When I'm Dead. I really enjoyed it, and for those of you who have read it, I bet you did as well. So if you read the book, let us know what you thought about the book, or maybe you have a question about the book itself. Or if you didn't read the book, certainly love to hear from you as well. Maybe you want to know about the research Hannah does on her crime and detective work. Want to hear from you. Regardless, the number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Hannah Morrissey, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
I tell you what, I really enjoyed your book. It was a lot of fun and a little chilling.
Good. bone chilling, I hope.
Bone chilling is a proper term for it, and the title, When I'm Dead. What gave you the idea for the book?
That's a really great question. I think with all of my books so far in the Black Harbor series, I've really been interested in the kind of periphery characters of law enforcement. So I love writing my detective characters, but I'm really interested in like those supporting characters. So in Hello Transcriber, the protagonist was a transcriber, a police transcriber, and I used to do that job, actually. Mm-hmm. And then in The Widowmaker, a little bit different. The other main character is a photographer who's paired up with a detective. And honestly, with When I'm Dead, one of my friends suggested you should write a book with a medical examiner as the main character. And I was like, that would be super cool. And I know absolutely nothing about medical examiners. So I needed to go find one. And
so you found one.
I did. And she was just wonderful and just helped me a lot. I love doing my research of just really getting out there and talking to people in those professions.
So you've got what you call the murder board.
Yes.
And so the medical examiner you met, she must be part of the murder board.
Oh, they're all on the murder board. The murder board has become an integral part of my writing process, I guess. I mean, every writer has their own process, and for me, it starts and ends with the murder board. The murder board came about when I was working on The Widowmaker, the second book in the series, and there were just so many characters, and not just the sheer amount of characters, but just they all connected, like in some way or multiple ways in some cases. And I was like, I need one of those big whiteboards like the detectives have in the bureau, like with
sure.
the string connecting the yeah. characters and stuff. So I've been making those for myself. I just print out my characters' pictures, I write them little bios, I connect them, and that's the murder board.
it's great.
Oh, thank you.
And you met the medical examiner, if I'm not mistaken. I remember a reading mm-hmm. at the end. You met her at a coffee shop or a bar or something. And
yeah. Oh my gosh, it was. I don't even know what she looked like. I just remembered from my days as a police transcriber that there was this. I think we had four medical examiners for our county, and I'm like, there was one who the cops always wanted her to show up on the scene because she was so thorough and would explain things in a way that
were helpful, I suppose.
Was helpful and like just very understandable to people who weren't medical examiners. And I asked my husband, who's in law enforcement, I asked him, I said, do you remember who that was? And he said, oh, that's Becky. And I was like, could I talk to Becky? So he called Becky's husband and explained, my wife is writing a book. She wants to have a medical examiner character. Could she talk to her? And yeah, Becky just met me out at some hole-in-the-wall bar and just told me like everything she knows.
And the side comment you had in that at the end there was everybody was trying to listen.
Oh my gosh, you should have seen the rubbernecking.
Everybody was trying to listen in on your conversation.
Yes.
Well, we should, for those who haven't read your book, tell me, When I'm Dead, mm-hmm. Maybe first give us the outline of the book.
Yeah.
And the reason for the title, When I'm Dead.
For sure, yeah. So When I'm Dead, I'm biased, but I do think now is the perfect time of year to read it because it does take place over Halloween. And so it starts off, there's a main character, our medical examiner, Rowan, and her husband is Axel. He's a homicide detective. And they live in this very crime-ridden, you know, fictionalized Wisconsin town of Black Harbor. And you can imagine if it's this very crime-ridden city, Rowan and Axel are very busy with their careers all the time. And I just kind of started thinking about that. Like, you know, if both of your parents are in law enforcement, you might feel, you know, a little bit alone sometimes. And taking, you know, putting a child in there who's, you know, teenage, like these formative years, and like teenagers can be angsty. I think we know that. So, you know, just this idea that Axel and Rowan are going to their daughter, Chloe, who's 15. They're going to her high school play. And in the middle of it, they get called out to investigate a murder that's happened in their neighborhood. And so they leave quickly at intermission. They go investigate this murder. And the victim is Chloe's best friend. And then when they return home that night, Chloe is missing.
Yeah.
So it becomes a question of, I mean, number one, where is Chloe? But then the more they like delve into their daughter's history and like what they know about her, or maybe don't know about her, it becomes, you know, is she capable of murder and is she culpable?
Yeah. Give us a sense. Can you read a page or so from the book to give us a sense of what it sounds like? Yeah, something right from the beginning, I think.
Yeah. I mean, the beginning's the best place to start, right? Yeah. So the first, this chapter is from Rowan's perspective, the mom, and it starts, "You'll love me more when I'm dead." The memory of her daughter's words makes the hair on the back of her neck stand up. Or perhaps it's just Black Harbor and the way she can't help but feel chilled to the bone whenever she finds herself skulking in its shadows. 18 years in this purgatory, Rowan would have thought she'd be used to it by now. It could be that there are some things you never get used to. Babies in dumpsters, brains smeared on sidewalks, junkies lying on the lawn, their last needle offering a stiff salute from their basilic vein. Dead girls in gullies. Shards of white glint on the river rocks, little snowflake fractals. But it's only mid-October in Wisconsin, which means it's too early for anything but hoarfrost. The broken triangles are teeth, knocked out of the skull of her daughter's best friend. Madison Caldwell lives just around the bend, a handful of houses down. Lived. Rowan shines her flashlight on the corpse. It stares up at a starless sky, head nesting on tendrils of blonde hair. The skin is snowy and soft. The eyes float in pools of plum-colored bruises. Crouching low, Rowan flutters the eyelashes and receives no response. She presses two fingers to the victim's neck then and feels nothing. After she lifts them, her prints stay there in white, blanching the skin. Next to them is a red mark. Rowan squints and leans closer. A hickey? She turns the victim's head and examines the other side. A second mark peeks from beneath the hood. With her work phone, she snaps a picture of each injury and hears the sound of leaves shuffling as an evidence technician crouches to place a yellow placard by what appears to be a set of house keys. No chance they belong to the killer. They wouldn't get that lucky. The scene is crawling with law enforcement. There are 10 officers with flashlights and black memo pads, including the 4 members of the Violent Crime Task Force. At least 2 officers must have gone to notify the parents. It's a responsibility usually reserved for a sergeant or lieutenant, but they're too shorthanded to be concerned about formalities. A 15-year-old girl is dead. Someone has to tell her parents.
Oh. Okay, I think that's a good that's a good way to start the book. You're right. This Black Harbor, maybe give us a tour of Black Harbor. Can you give us a tour of Black Harbor?
Yeah. So, yeah, a lot of people ask, like, you know, why Black Harbor? Why make a fictionalized city, you know, versus like just taking, you know, a real place? And, you know, why the Midwest? And I think those are all, you know, super valid questions. And for me, for Black Harbor, it is very much inspired by like this southern part of Wisconsin, mm-hmm. Especially by the lake, like by Lake Michigan. I'm just so fascinated by that area. I love like just the way that the lake is eating the shoreline, and it feels like everything's getting pushed together and compressed. And I love these cities that, you know, they were once titans of industry. And when industry moves out, crime moves in. And so I love playing with that, like in my writing, like having the atmosphere create these really high tensions and then putting these characters who, you know, have to deal with that. And so, yeah, Black Harbor, I mean, really the idea came about when I was working at the Racine Police Department as a police transcriber, and I would work the night shift. So I worked 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. And I think it's important to think about what lens you're seeing the world, because you're asleep during daylight when normal things are happening. And then when I'm awake, it's just typing. I would just put on a headset and listen as detectives would tell me every dirty little secret about the city that was happening, all the murders, the robberies, you know, and anything you could think of, literally. And I would just type that in the dark all the time. And we would get a fair number of like suicides, like jumpers from the railroad bridge. And I used to see this railroad bridge all the time. Every time I drove into work and when I would drive home from work, that railroad bridge was there. And I love that bridge because it's so scary. And I would just sit at my desk and think, like, what kind of place is so bad that people think the only way out is to jump off that bridge? And that's what got me creating this Black Harbor.
Hannah Morrissey, our guest today, she's the author of, obviously, crime fiction is what she does. And believe me, she does it well. And the book we're talking about, our book club selection, is titled When I'm Dead. Questions for her, I hope you'll join in, or some comments. The number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look today at the book When I'm Dead with the author Hannah Morrissey, part of our book club selection on the Larry Mueller Show Book Club. It's great to have her with us. Questions, thoughts for her, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I think your books have been called maybe the best part of Midwest noir subgenre. How accurate is that? You know, what is that? How accurate is that label?
I'm very happy to have, you know, kind of carved out this new niche of Midwestern noir. It comes from, I've thought about this a lot, you know, especially when people say, why the Midwest? And especially like, you know, why are you writing thrillers and crime fiction, you know, in the Midwest? And I think about Scandinavian noir and the elements of Scandinavian noir, which often is a, you know, a cold, remote setting.
Yeah.
And, you know, If the people won't kill you in those books, the elements will.
Yeah.
And we have that here. I mean, we have the cold, remote settings, the dark, you know, everlasting nights, it seems, like these perpetual winters. And I just think, why not? I mean, we absolutely have that here, and the Midwest is so much more than these flyover states that we get, you know, that we get pegged as. And I think that in fiction, the Midwest is often underrepresented.
Yeah.
And I just, that was something that was really funny to me when I started out my publishing journey, because, you know, when you start out, you need to get a literary agent.
Yeah.
And once you finally get some interest, I mean, it took me several manuscripts to finally get some interest from a literary agent. And then once one calls you, then there's a bunch of people, then there's a bunch of them calling you, because they're like, oh, this must be good. So they would all say, we just love the setting, we love the atmosphere. And finally I was like, why? And they're like, well, it's exotic to us. And I was like, exotic? And they're like, well, you know, most of us are in New York, and a lot of books take place in New York or New England or, you know, Massachusetts. So they're like, we never get to go to Wisconsin.
that is amazing. But you got to get that. You got to work to get that first one, and then.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, I wasn't writing thrillers before either, so this was my first foray into thrillers. I guess was what I was really meant to be writing. So.
So you have many threads that run through the novel.
Mm-hmm.
And I like how you use your chapters as, I think there's three people who are primarily, I think the murderer gets a chapter or two at the end, but you write from the perspective of an individual.
Right.
So it's Alex, it's Libby.
Mm-hmm.
And it's
Rowan.
Yep. I suddenly blanked on her name there for a minute.
This is a quiz.
So those are the three, I think.
Yeah. Yep. So, yeah, I really enjoyed it. I mean, that was such a challenge of this book, but I really enjoyed it. Just thinking about, I knew that I wanted to have Rowan, the medical examiner, and the mom be a point of view character. And I knew that I wanted her husband, Axel, the homicide detective, and the dad to be a point of view character, because I liked the tension that I could create between the two of them.
Oh,
of,
yeah.
You know, they both have one, they have the same goal. They want to find their daughter, but they have differing opinions on how to do it, and they have differing opinions on who she is. So I really liked that, having these two characters who should absolutely be coming together in this time of crisis be kind of torn apart.
Yeah.
And, you know, also like they're grieving parents. So that's another element to add to their relationship dynamic. But then, so I'm like, that's great. Rowan can get me up close with the bodies because, I mean,
yeah,
there's going to be more than one body.
Yeah.
It's Black Harbor after all. So Rowan can get me up close to the body. She can get me into the morgue, because why would you write a medical examiner character if you're not going to go into the morgue? And Axel can get me up close to the investigation. He can get me to canvassing, interviewing suspects, and like actually working the case. But then I realized, I'm like, I need another lens. I need to know what's happening in that school, because that's the first place you would look.
The high school.
Right. If a 15-year-old is missing and there's been rumors going around about her and other people and, you know, teachers and whatnot, like you're going to need to be in that school.
Yeah, and one of them's murdered.
Right.
And one of the
yeah, yeah. So that's where Libby, the 16-year-old neighbor, became a point of view character, because she could get me in. She could get me into the school.
I really like that. It seemed to move the book. It was
good.
A nice way to move the book mm-hmm. forward.
Yeah.
And I also like your technique of, which is, other authors do this as well, but you do it particularly well, which is to give us maybe sometimes it's not so little, but the last sentence or two sentences of every chapter there's some fact.
Oh, good.
Or there's something that's almost forces you to read the next chapter and keep moving.
Oh, good. I work at that. Every that's kind of a rule of thrillers is that every chapter should end on either a revelation or a like dun dun dun.
Yeah. Well, it does that, and you good. And Libby. I think I found her almost the most interesting. Describe Libby.
Libby is one of my favorite things to come out of this book. And I was nervous to write her at first because I don't typically write like teenage characters. And I was nervous because I'm like, I don't want it to sound like a young adult book. And I want her to be a believable 16-year-old. Sometimes you read books and it's a pet peeve of mine when the kids are too smart.
Yeah.
So I actually had fun with having her misstep and mess up sometimes because she's going to sometimes think that she's smarter than she is. And so Libby is, you know, she's the girl next door. She's very awkward. She's very insecure. And she has she's definitely got a quirk. And the thing about quirks is they're great because they make your characters memorable, but they're even better when that quirk gets them in trouble. And so Libby's quirk, I guess, is that she has an affinity for dead things and she likes taxidermy. And when characters, you know, start up being murdered and missing pieces, it's not looking so good for Libby.
Yeah, she's one of the suspects. Yeah. There are quite a few suspects in the book. There's four that come to mind right off the top of my head. There's even Chloe, the missing daughter, comes as one, and Libby herself. And there's a drama teacher, Mr. Cutler.
Yep.
And there's Reeves.
Yep.
Who is the boyfriend of the murdered girl and a soccer player and a big athlete and so forth. But a kid that has a sensitive kid in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So those, and then there's another, I mean, I always write down the number of characters, you know, as I'm reading. I can show you how I take notes.
Oh, it's like your own little murder board.
I have my own little murder board, and I always write down all of the various people. And there's at least a dozen other, you know, total of at least a dozen characters. In fact, it's more like 15, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like with this. I suppose, you know, not to, you know, pat myself on the back, but what I'm pleased about with this world of Black Harbor is that it's basically, you know, it's this environment that I can just draw from and like pull characters from. And, you know, some of them do appear in other books. So, I mean, When I'm Dead reads as a standalone because it is a unique set of protagonists. It's a whole new mystery, but there are characters that will hop into, you know, different books throughout the series. And what I've learned about the people in Black Harbor is like everyone kind of deserves a side eye. Like nobody's super wholesome here in this town.
Jeff, did we take a break yet? I can't remember. We did take the first break and I've forgotten about it. This conversation is going is so much fun. I can't remember what I've done and what I haven't done. So that's a good thing. You can join in too. We got an email from Barry, but you can email us a question if you want. Ideas at talk@wpr.org or give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Barry emailed us. He says, it sounds like an interesting book. Your author reminded him of a passage in Scott Peck's book, The Road Less Traveled, where he describes a man who's driving toward an underpass, and the thought occurs to him that the bridge is going to fall on him. So he avoids the underpass and finds another route home, and that night he's lying in bed and thinking that his avoiding the bridge was ridiculous. So he puts his coat on over his pajamas and drives down to the bridge and drives underneath it over and over again until a cop sees him and wonders what he's up to. Peck says that insane behavior is usually a reaction to otherwise common stimuli. Yeah. A good premise for murder. What do you think?
Yeah.
One of the things that you do really well is describing people and the settings, the high school, what goes on in a high school with the kids,
mm-hmm.
and unbeknownst to parents,
right?
A lot. You do a great job of explaining the sort of the dynamics.
Oh, thank you.
Going on between kids, the kids themselves in the school, and then between the kids and some of the teachers.
Mm-hmm. I was nervous about that too.
It's really good.
Oh,
thought,
thank
oh,
you.
Man, it made me think about my own high school days.
Good. Well, God, I was just thinking. I'm like, it has been. I couldn't tell you how long it's been since I've been in a school,
yeah.
But I was like, what happens in these schools? So luckily, just like I, you know, had my friend, the medical examiner, I had my friend Elena, who I think she was 16, 17 at the time I was writing this book,
mm-hmm.
My friend's daughter. So I would just ask her, like, what kind of stuff goes on? What kind of rumors do you guys spread there? And like, what? How do you guys communicate? Snapchat. I'm like, okay.
Mm-hmm. So you really, I think, caught the flavor.
Oh, thank you.
Of what goes on among the kids that, and what goes on, and what goes, and then through Libby too, you get a lot mm-hmm. of what goes through the mind of a 15-year-old girl.
Right. And I loved, with this book, I loved playing with rumors. So a theme that's become really prevalent throughout the Black Harbor series, the detective character, Nikolai Cole, he's like the one character who is present throughout every book.
Yeah.
And he says everybody lies. So everybody lies has become a major theme of the series. And I just really liked taking that for a little bit of a spin and using that in the form of rumors and just how rumors affect people. And because I think with certain characters, like, you know, there was a really bad rumor going around about Chloe and the drama teacher, and that was absolutely, you know, ruinous.
Yeah. And there's and earlier you mentioned a bridge.
Mm-hmm.
That existed where you used to work. And I thought at that moment, I wondered if the bridge there's somebody who actually dies off of a bridge in this book.
Yes.
And takes a jump off the bridge. Was that the same bridge?
It is. Honestly, that I should backtrack a minute and say that, yes, the detective Nikolai Cole is in every book, but so is that bridge. So it's called Forge Bridge in the book, and it's present in every book. It's very present in the first one. It's, you know, quite a character in and of itself. And yeah, somebody jumps from that bridge every book.
Jumps or maybe pushed.
Right. Yeah. Maybe pushed.
And maybe pushed. Well, mm-hmm. The book, I think gives the reader a great, pretty good behind the scenes look at detective work. We're mm-hmm. going to be talking with a real live detective from Green Bay at noon today about what goes into it. But you, your research, talk about your research relating to that. A lot of that's based on probably your husband.
My husband worked as a, you know, patrol officer, worked his way up to detective, sergeant, lieutenant, all the way through the Racine Police Department for like 20, 21 years. And then in the last year and a half or so, became special agent for the Division of Criminal Investigation for the Department of Justice here in Wisconsin. So They're kind of like the state's FBI. They assist other police departments who maybe don't have the resources or the expertise. So I do a lot of my research through him, and he is just so great at sitting down with me and working things out, because I'm not a detective. Mm-hmm. But in so many ways, even if you're not writing a mystery or a crime fiction book, you know, you have mm-hmm. to do your own investigating as a writer. And I mean, we've gone so far as to, we'll role play interviews. So I'll be like the suspect that I'm writing about, and he's the detective interviewing me.
Oh, yeah. Very cool.
So from that, I can get, you know, what's actually being said, like how the detective would actually speak to the suspect or whoever they're talking to, because it's really important for me to have that dialogue be authentic and sound real. And I mean, I'll make like miniature editions of my murder board. So I'll just print out like miniature pictures of all my characters and then lay them out like on the kitchen counter, and we can move them around. Like, okay, this person would clearly be doing this, or this person's clearly, you know, culpable for this. So yeah, it gets pretty wild.
and the tells, you do a nice job with the tells. And how a detective looks at it. And I wrote one down here. How to get to know people are lying by mm-hmm. maybe it's how they retract their lips, as you mm-hmm. write about, or how they might swipe their chin mm-hmm. When they're telling a lie.
Yeah, I know Libby has a big one in this book.
And I think we can tell that. We can at least say what it is. It's a necklace.
Her tell, yeah, she holds on to her locket, which is actually the one on the cover of the book.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I wondered if that was a locket that you had.
No, it wasn't. I don't even remember where the locket came from, honestly.
Well, it's one of those, you see the lockets on the cover. It's kind right. of an interesting. But then when you're done with the book, mm-hmm. you go back and look at the cover and you say, oh, man, this yeah. this tells yeah. a lot, gives us a lot of, gave us a lot of information in retrospect.
Right.
You would never figure it out.
Yeah.
You would never figure out the importance of that locket mm-hmm. by just looking at the locket.
Mm-hmm.
Because he really caught me that was a big surprise, the locket itself.
Oh, good.
My mouth opened, I think. My jaw dropped a little bit when I looked at that. Oh my gosh. Stories about crime, whether they're true crime or crime fiction, they're really popular right now, especially
yeah.
in podcasts, but movies and books. Why do you think it is that people enjoy hearing about crime and the darker side of mm-hmm. humans?
I mean, I feel like, for me, I think humans, we just naturally have like this morbid fascination with things that we wouldn't do. So I think that's why we like reading about, you know, murder or writing about it, because it's almost like an examination of somebody that's other than human. Like, could human, are, you know, is that a human that's responsible, you know, for, you know, taking the life of another, and what creates these monsters, what pushes them to that edge, and then also just this fascination with the people working those cases. And everybody loves a mystery.
Yeah.
So it's just, like you said, like picking up those threads and seeing where they lead and what connects to what. And that's what I like. I mean, I like puzzles. So it's like, you know, putting a big puzzle together and seeing where the pieces fit.
Bill in Green Lake emailed us. He said he hasn't read the book yet, But also concerned that naming things like suspects will spoil the discovery.
Well, everybody's a suspect.
Yeah, there. Believe me, there are so many suspects. And Bill, when you read the book, you're gonna it'll become apparent who the suspects are.
Yeah, we haven't given any spoilers.
Yeah. There was even one. Well, maybe I shouldn't even mention this, but there's one really good friend of the protagonist, the main person. Rowan, I should, mm-hmm. God, why can't I remember Rowan's name? A good friend of Rowan's who mm-hmm. had even crossed my mind about her.
Oh, good.
Once or twice in the book.
See, everyone gets a side eye.
Everybody gets a side eye. Well, yeah. Here's one for you. Hannah Morrissey, our guest today, her book that we're talking about is When I'm Dead. And love to hear from you. Give us a call. The number 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining in on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Well, it's a book club day, and we're talking with the author of our book club selection, Hannah Morrissey. Her book is titled When I'm Dead, and she has it's part of the Black Harbor Mystery Series that she started. This is the third. The first two are Hello, Transcriber, and the other, The Widowmaker, and I haven't read the first two, and fortunately, I guess this one, When I'm Dead, is mm-hmm. does not, it stands alone.
Yeah.
Are the first two standalones as well?
Yes. So each book they all take place in the same like universe of Black yeah. Harbor, but they all have unique protagonists and unique mysteries. So there are characters that will occur in other books, but you know, for instance, like say take the detective Nikolai Cole, who's a major character in Hello Transcriber. He's a supporting character in both The Widowmaker and When I'm Dead, and then he'll return in the fourth book as a main character.
Yeah, which is coming up, and I'm going to want to, we'll definitely talk about that fourth book that's coming up before we get to the end. Themes, there are many themes, and I did want to talk about a few of the other themes. One is family.
Mm-hmm.
Family's a big theme in When I'm Dead, and there are some sad scenes,
mm-hmm.
but there are also some, I think, heartwarming ones
mm-hmm.
as well when it comes to family. How do you approach writing about something as complex as family?
Yeah. No, that's a great question, and I had not written a book until this one with a family at the center. So I think a lot of it is just like looking at that. For me, it's a thriller, right? So it's going to be dark and bad things are going to happen. So I just look at this little family unit that I've got of Rowan, Axel, and Chloe and be like, what's the worst thing that I can make happen to them? So I'm going to break them apart in this horrendous way, and I'm going to see how they can put themselves back together. So in that way, it's a lot of like exploring, you know, resilience and love and grief. And I think that's what's so great about like thrillers is that they are dark and they are scary sometimes and they're suspenseful. But they're also, like you said, they have like some heartwarming moments. And there's this idea that I like cling to of that, you know, I used to think that pitch dark and light can coexist, but now I know that it's that pitch dark and light must coexist. So even if your world or the situation seems hopeless, you have to put at least a glimmer of hope in there that the characters are reaching for and can attain. So it's like taking this family and like rooting for them to like rooting for the husband and wife to like work together and find their daughter. And how do they, you know, if they do, how do they rebuild? Because this has been traumatic for everybody. And what happens if they don't find her?
Yeah, what happens then?
Right.
And you're sort of rooting along the way that things are going to turn out. But there's also, connected with the family, but there's also a theme of trust.
Mm-hmm.
So trying to believe a loved one, trying not to believe a young one could be a killer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that was...
And then the tension between the two people.
Yeah, and I think that's something that I... When I murder board and when I put my characters up there, I always ask them a couple of questions. One of them being, you know, what do you want most in the world? What's stopping you from getting it? And what's your greatest fear? And what's your quirk? Mm-hmm. And so when you take their greatest fears, you know that whatever their greatest fear is, each character is going to have to face that at some point throughout the book. And Rowan's greatest fear is a little bit different than Axel's, where Rowan's greatest fear is that, you know, somebody has Chloe and they're doing horrible things to her. And so she would almost rather that she's dead.
Yeah.
And she can't fathom the thought of her daughter being tortured or her daughter like torturing and killing somebody else. So she'd rather that she's dead because to her, dead is safe. And then Axel is completely the opposite. He is willing to entertain the idea that Chloe could be a murderer if it means he can find her alive. So sort of what dark parts are you willing to look into of like yourself and your loved ones? And yeah, it becomes a huge question of like, who can you trust and who's lying? And, you know, because if you don't have trust, like you don't have anything.
Yeah. And there's there's some side characters that come into play that, may or may not have anything to do with the rest of the story, and kind of fun little sidetracks. One has to do with pumpkins, because this is a perfect time for to be talking about the book, because it's sort of like everybody's setting out their pumpkins, and their pumpkins are disappearing. Now, how did that happen to fly into the book?
Oh, the pumpkin lady. Honestly, my sister was over one night and just showing me these videos that were on, it was some Facebook community group for her neighborhood, and people were posting these videos of this woman who would come to their like porch and steal their pumpkins, and she would put them in her stroller and walk away. And I mean, it did look pretty creepy. Like if you were just watching, you know, from a black and white, like surveillance camera. And I just started wondering about that lady and like constructing this character and like, why would somebody steal pumpkins and put them in a stroller? And I won't give anything away, but for me, in many ways, the pumpkin lady is a foil to Rowan of like what could happen to her. So like Rowan very much sees herself in the pumpkin lady in some ways.
And likes the pump. Yeah.
Yeah. I won't give any spoilers, but kind of, I like when there's some surprises in the books that I read where something's not what it seems or it's not what you thought.
Where did you first find your love for writing? Must go back a ways, because you were a student here at the University of Wisconsin.
Yeah.
In writing.
Yep. I went to UW-Madison for English and an emphasis in creative writing. So I always knew that's what I wanted to do. I've been writing forever.
And what's, you've kind of given us an idea of what your process is like, but what is your writing process?
Yeah. Well, once I'm working on a book, like once it's been murder boarded, And it's like, you know, I'll have the murder board up and I'll go and add things to it here and there, but for the most part it's pretty set. And then I just go to my computer and I write. I get up, I write from 5 a.m. to about 11 or noon every day.
So you write a long stretch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then I don't know, I'll go do yoga or take my pugs for a walk, and I'll kind of take a break until like 2 o'clock or so, and then I get back to it for maybe 2 hours, and usually doing more like non-writing things at that point, like answering emails or
yeah,
planning things, or social media planning is such a big part of the gig now.
It is, and as part of that, you have a book trailer out. Mm-hmm. For When I'm Dead. I went and looked at your book trailers, which
good.
I love.
Oh, awesome.
I love those trailers, but somebody else said to me, what the heck's a book trailer? And so maybe explain that and how you put those together, because they really make you want to look at the book.
Oh, great. My sister makes them for me, actually. And yeah, I mean, she makes them like so cinematic. It looks like a movie. A book trailer is exactly what it sounds like. It's almost like a trailer for a movie, like a preview, except a book. And yeah, just kind of taking some of the most exciting snippets that can give you a glimpse of what's inside.
Yeah. Jill Nadeau, our executive producer, says she's glad, she's happy when actual faces aren't used.
Yeah.
I mean, in one of your trailers, you see two people kissing. There are mm-hmm. people kissing, but you don't see the people.
Right.
It's sort of an outline, mm-hmm. whatever.
Mm-hmm. I like to leave it up to people's imaginations for the most part.
I think that's a good idea, and I think it does help spur interest. I'm certainly going back, by the way, to buy the other two books because you've really inspired me, and actually this whole conversation has even inspired me a bit more. And you've got another book coming out.
Yes.
It's called The Unlucky Ones.
Yeah. So that is the fourth one in the Black Harbor series. And so we do see characters from it. It is, I don't, the verdict's not quite in yet if it is entirely a standalone as much as the other three are. However, I would say you would enjoy it the most if you've read Hello Transcriber, because the two main characters for that one come back in the fourth one. And yeah, I mean, I'm so happy with how it turned out. It's getting really great reviews so far, just from the early reads. And this is the only one that takes place in like a scorching summer, because my editor asked, can we have some like warm weather for once, Hannah? And I was like, fine, you can get our insufferable summer.
How's this one done? Have you been happy with how this?
When I'm Dead? Yeah. When I'm Dead has brought a lot more people to the whole series, since it just like kind of picked up some speed, and it got picked up for a Book of the Month Club last October, which it really brought a lot of people. It was a great entry point to the world, and so a lot of people are starting with When I'm Dead and then going back to read the first two.
Well, that's what I'm going to do.
Good.
Thank you so much. Hannah, it has been a real joy talking with
you.
Oh,
this has been great.
I hope when that next book comes out, we'll get a chance to talk with you again. Thank you so much.
Oh, me too. Thank you.
Hannah Morrissey, our guest today, and her book, When I'm Dead, and one of the third in her three-part Black Harbor mystery series. Great to have her with us. And to keep along with the theme, we have a real-life detective coming up next to talk about crime solving. That next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Little theme music from the television show Beretta to get us going on this segment of our program here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here talking about police detectives and what they do during and after a crime is reported. Craig Bray is our guest. He's a detective at the Green Bay Police Department. Detective Bray has worked at the city of Green Bay since 2013. He's done police work for more than 20 years. And we'll talk with him today about how, maybe a little bit about how he became a detective. And you'll hear how police investigate missing persons cases. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions about police detective work. Let us know what you wonder about how detectives investigate crimes. Or maybe you're a police officer. What do you wish fellow community members knew about the work that you do? I hope you'll give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Detective Craig Bray with us by phone today. Welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining in.
Thank you for having me.
Well, as I mentioned, I think a lot of people enjoy fictional stories about crime, but when you see crime and police work on TV, how accurate is it in your mind?
Well, like some of the, I guess the cases that they would profile on TV are be similar to the type of cases we handle in real life. The biggest difference is the time period. You know, we have this thing called the CSI effect where, you know, the police on TV investigate crime and they get DNA results and, you know, results immediately. When we know that oftentimes these types of things take months, if not years, for us to get back on a lot of the forensics. So,
yeah. So, given that, what's your day-to-day job look like?
I'm in the sensitive crime division. So we investigate physical and sexual abuse. And then we also help out on any major crimes that occur in the city, like a homicide. And we also work on missing persons. But from day to day, the office, the district attorney's office in Brown County, we work with community partners because we have a multidisciplinary team as part of the sensitive crime, which is comprised of Child Protective Services, Willow Tree, which is our child advocate, and then the sexual assault in the office. So when we get cases, which we get several cases a week, I'll start working with our community partners to figure out the best approach to work on cases.
We are having a few voice problems. So actually, you're sounding fine, but you're breaking up a little bit. So we're going to try and set up another set up for you, maybe on a Google Meet or something, Greg. But just so you know that we're setting that up, and we'll probably be moving to that in just a minute. In the meantime, if you have questions for Detective Craig Bray, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us, the email address, talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you. What inspired you, Craig, to become a police officer?
I've wanted to be a police since I was old. My uncle was,
We're breaking up. So I'll tell you what, we're going to take a little break and we're going to get you on a Google Meet and then we'll be back. And again, You can join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and our guest today that we're talking with is Craig Bray. Craig is a detective at the Green Bay Police Department, and because of the show that we had just preceding this, the segment, Hannah Morrissey's book, When I'm Dead, involved detective work. We thought it'd be interesting to carry that further and look at a real live detective and what the real live detectives have to do. And we have Craig Bray on. I think we have him on by a Google Meet right now. Craig, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Having a little trouble hearing you there, Craig. So we're having a little bit of difficulty here. We'll get that straightened out in just a second or two. In the meantime, just a reminder: Garden Talk tomorrow from 11 to 1. We've got a couple of different things to talk about. We're going to be talking about. Let's see. I'm not sure what we're talking about because the information. Oh, we're talking about earth-friendly gardens and woody ornamentals, if I'm not mistaken, as well on tomorrow's show. Well, let's see if we got Craig with us now. Craig, you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now. Thank you so much. I had asked you what, you know, and maybe you can go back to this. What's your day-to-day life like on the job?
So my day-to-day work experience is I work in sensitive crimes in the Green Bay Police Department. There's three detectives in the sensitive crimes, and we investigate all child deaths, physical and sexual abuse of children, major sexual assaults of adults, and any other major crime that might come out, including up to homicide. So we work with community partners like Child Protective Services, the Child Advocacy Center, which is Willow Tree, and the Sexual Assault Center in the Brown County DA's office to investigate these cases. And so when we come in at the beginning of our shift, we'll have cases assigned to us, and then we start working with our community partners to investigate this the best possible.
Yeah, I want to ask you about becoming a detective, because I think that there's got to be a process involved with that. How'd you end up becoming a detective?
Well, I started my law enforcement career in January of 1999. I worked for a couple of smaller agencies. You always have to start out in patrol with every agency. You work patrol, you do specialty stuff. And the more experience you get on patrol, and especially things like maybe like a SWAT team or a CCIT, which would be like a crisis intervention team, a drug unit, all that stuff, you develop your skills and your ability to do the job as a eventually as a detective, which would encompass all that stuff in your career. And after several years of, you know, working as a patrol officer, I eventually took the detective test and fortunately was able to pass it, and became a detective in 2019 at the Green Bay Police Department.
God, it's by the time you're a detective, you've done pretty much everything when it comes to police work before you get there, from the sound of it.
Yeah, the more specialty units, the more patrol time you have, is definitely going to make you a better candidate to be a detective, because when you're a detective, you're expected to know how all the ins and outs of every department and every specialty unit work.
Yeah. What kind of tips, I guess we should say, should you have, can you give folks for working with a police officer or a detective? After, let's say you've called 911 to report a crime. What are the tips for working with a police officer?
So
My guess, my best advice for working with a police officer is whoever calls and is requesting assistance from the police, they kind of set the tone. They kind of determine how things are going to go. Obviously, people call the police because situations have gotten out of control or they don't know what to do as far as they need help. And the police officer's there to give them advice, help them take their report, whatever it may be. But I guess the best advice I can give is when you report a crime or you need help, make sure that you communicate well with the officer and that you tell them everything that has happened, whether you think it's important or not important for the case. And then always just communicate with the officer as best as possible so that as additional information comes in, it can be relayed to the police officer.
Yeah, and I'm sure it all varies by circumstances. Is there a priority? Do you guys have a priority of which calls to respond to first? Or
so when patrol gets dispatched, it goes through the Brown County Dispatch Center, and they do prioritize calls, of course. Here in Green Bay, we are very busy. Our patrol officers take a lot of calls. I want to say they average between 80 and 90,000 calls a year for service. So it does get prioritized. And unfortunately, some of the, I guess, lower priority calls, which would be like maybe like a minor theft or something, is going to take, is not going to be priority compared to like something that's immediately occurring, like some sort of physical assault. Or an accident in traffic or something like that.
Yeah. I'm thinking about various circumstances as the person who's going to make the call or, you know, ask for help. And I'm thinking about, all right, grandpa's missing or an adult, let's just say an adult shows up missing. I mean, when do you report something like that? How long do you wait to report something like that?
Well, it's not like you see on TV. We would expect someone to report immediately. I mean, people know their families the best, and if something doesn't seem right and someone's missing, we would expect them to report that immediately, because the sooner we can get the information and we can start notifying officers to look for, you know, the said missing person, is, you know, the quicker that we're going to be able to come to a resolution with the case.
So do it, yeah. Don't wait around. And obviously, the same would hold true if a child is missing. I think that almost would go without saying.
Correct.
And after you report a person is missing, you guys are on it pretty quickly, typically.
Yeah, we, like I said, when a person is reported as missing, we start the investigation immediately. We try to determine the severity. You know, does this person have medical needs? What is their age? Is this something that's happened in the past? And other risk factors, you know, whether they're drug dependent, stuff like that. We want to know right away.
It makes a lot of sense to me. So what are strategies you might use, or other police detectives might use, in locating a missing person?
So we rely heavily on the family and friends to let us know like patterns of the missing person, where they might frequent, social media apps, try to figure out who they're communicating with, and then to immediately get patrol out, checking areas, and just notifying the public as to what we're looking for, because the public does like to help in these situations, and we rely heavily on the public station to locate missing people.
And then what happens after you find a previously missing person? What happens then?
So fortunately, we have a lot of resources in Green Bay. So we, you know, determine why someone went missing, if they were convinced to go with someone, or if they're depressed, or if they just wanted to get away and didn't want to be bothered. You know, all those things we take into factor, and then we determine what the best outcome is by, you know, offering them resources. If they need to go to the crisis center, if they need to go to the hospital,
or if they just want to go back with family, or if they're fine and there's no, I guess, danger, we can just note that they're in good health and they just don't want to be bothered.
Oh, okay. It makes sense. To me, for sure. Conrad called, couldn't stay with us. Is there a way that police can tell if someone is hearing impaired or deaf?
That's a good question. And that there we would rely back on the family or close friend to notify us of any like medical needs that the person may need. If that was the case, we do have resources to help us communicate with hearing impaired people.
Our guest today, Craig Bray, detective at the Green Bay Police Department, and we're talking with him about detective work. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments as we move along. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Let's talk about forensics for a minute, because forensics is always, it almost amuses me, and I don't know anything about being a detective, but it kind of amuses me when I see a NCIS show or the FBI show, because they're really quick at getting that information that is almost unbelievably fast. How do you use science to help you evaluate a crime scene?
So we have a forensics unit that's comprised of three civilians. So when we get a major scene and it needs to be processed, we usually call in our forensics unit, and they will start taking swabs of various areas that we find, like blood or touch DNA, and we determine what needs to be sent to a crime lab. And we work with, for DNA, we work with the state crime lab out of Madison. So what we can do is if we don't have a suspect, but we have a belief that this is the blood from the suspect or touch DNA or a hair, we can send that information or those swabs to the crime lab, and they can develop what's called an unknown DNA profile. So once we get that profile developed, then we can try to develop a suspect. If we do develop a suspect, we can get what's called a standard buccal swab, which is a swab of the inner cheek of the suspect. That's a controlled DNA swab, and we send that to the lab for comparison. And then they'll determine if this unknown DNA profile from the crime scene matches the suspect. And that's one of the things that we use a lot and on a lot of our crime scenes, and we've had really good success with DNA hits. Another thing that they can do with DNA is if someone is also a convicted felon and their DNA is in CODIS, and if the crime is serious enough, they will put that DNA profile in the CODIS, and they will run that profile against all the profiles that are already in CODIS to see if we get a match. If we do get a match, then we would have to go and get that controlled sample from that suspect at that time.
And if it is a match, I mean, is it legally okay for you to go and get the swab from somebody? Could somebody say, well, no, I'm not going to let you do that. That's my personal cheek that you want to swab.
Yep. That's a good question. So DNA doesn't change in a person. So there's no, when we seize property or someone's DNA, like there's got to be a circumstance that could be destroyed. Well, someone cannot destroy their DNA. So we would have to then go write a warrant to seize that. We would write what we call as a buccal standard warrant. And then we have it reviewed by a court commissioner or a judge. And if they feel there's enough probable cause to issue that warrant, they will issue it, and then we would serve that person with the warrant and obtain the buccal swab at that time. Otherwise, people can consent to it and just give us their DNA.
So there is a fair amount of really good technology that you probably didn't have, or you might not have had when you first started as a police officer 20 years ago.
Yeah, that's correct. The DNA has developed a lot since 1999. And then we also deal with, obviously, a lot of electronic stuff that we didn't deal with, back in the early 2000s or late 1990s, between social media apps, text messages, cell phone calls. That's another part of forensics that we get a lot of information and helps us in our investigations.
John emailed and wants to know, what do you look for when you're investigating a crime scene? You know, what are the most common clues that suggest suspects might leave at a crime scene?
Well, it could be anything from, like the DNA to sometimes people drop their personal property on a crime scene. There are so many cameras out there now. We will do a neighborhood canvas looking for any ring cameras, blink cameras, home security camera systems, and then just good witnesses. Talk to witnesses and then try and determine how the crime occurred. In a sense, reenact the crime a little bit. So it's a totality of a lot of different things that we initially look for. And we rely heavily on, the initial caller as to what information they provide us.
As I was thinking about the show today, I thought back, it's been a few years now, but there was two parents who were murdered, and the 13 or 14 year old daughter was taken. And in months went by, many, many, many months, and then the girl was actually able to escape from the person that had done it. But thinking about it, it was almost like a whim. The guy had happened to be driving by and saw the girl, and so he comes, and doesn't live in the area. There's no connection to the people at all, and he just kills the mother and dad and takes the daughter. And I was thinking about that from a detective's standpoint, because police are certainly going to be looking for connections, and sometimes there aren't any.
Yeah, those are for sure the toughest cases. When you have someone who doesn't use any sort of electronic social media, you have no video surveillance, you have no witnesses. You may have a suspect that has never committed a crime before, so you would not have any sort of fingerprints or DNA on file. So those cases are extremely tough, and that's sometimes a case like that will turn into a cold case.
Yeah, and I imagine you've had some experience with that, and it's probably not the ones you enjoy the most, for sure.
No, cold cases are extremely tough. Because you're trying to investigate something that happened years back, and things were obviously done different back in the 80s, 70s, or 90s, So you just got to kind of start from, step one and start working the case all over again.
Yeah, it's got to be tough. You are in the sensitive crimes unit. You're a sensitive crimes detective. Then someone else wonders, what does that all entail?
So we're part of a multidisciplinary team, it's called, here in Brown County, which is comprised of the three sensitive crimes detectives for the Green Bay Police Department, Child Protective Services of Brown County, the Willow Tree Child Advocacy Center, and the Family Services Sexual Assault Center. So when we get a crime against a child, some sort of abuse, whether it be physical or sexual, the first thing we do is obviously an officer will take an initial report, and then we set up what's called a forensic interview. And a forensic interview is done we have two forensic interviewers here in Brown County at the Willow Tree Child Advocacy Center, and they're very, very good at their job. And their job, I mean, they have other tasks, but their main purpose is to talk to children. They're not associated with the Brown County Brown County DA's office or the Green Bay Police Department. They don't do any of the investigation. They simply talk to the child
ask non-leading questions, and then myself, Child Protective Services, and maybe a prosecutor will watch the interview of the child. And children can be interviewed for other things too, like witness to a crime. So after the interview is completed, if a child discloses that a crime occurred to that child, then we start the investigation as far as talking to witnesses, talking to the suspect. And then if we determine that there's probable cause, we can either make an arrest and or refer charges over to the Brown County District Attorney's Office. And that whole time, we utilize the Sexual Assault Center to have an advocate there to help them with services, the victim of services.
Detective Craig Bray, our guest today of the Green Bay Police Department, as we talk about what he does and what other detectives do under crime situations. I'd love to hear from you. You can call us at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. You are also involved with officer training. How has officer training evolved over the years in terms of methods?
So, yeah, when I worked patrol, I was a field training officer. And it's probably one of the most important jobs because we need good police officers out there and we need good, hardworking police officers. So when I was a field training officer, I took that position very serious. We would basically, there's four phases of training with the Green Bay Police Department. You start with like phase one and you start taking minor calls for service, maybe like a 911 hangup, a simple theft with suspect. And then depending on how the officer does, and every officer starting out is different. We get some from other agencies that have a lot of experience where this may be the officer's very first job ever. So it depends on how fast they, start to understand the job. And then we evaluate every day how they interact with people, if they are obtaining the correct information, if they're writing good police reports. And then as they get more confident and develop their skills, they will advance to the next step. And each step can take anywhere from like 4 to 6 weeks, if not longer. Fortunately for the Green Bay Police Department, we're busy, so they get a lot of reps. Where some of the smaller agencies, which I've worked for smaller agencies, you don't get as many calls, so it takes a little bit longer to get used to what you need for what information you need per call that you go on.
So there's a lot of calls.
We do have a lot of calls. And when you're in the field training program, you're not stuck to like a sector of the city. So like you can jump any call that comes out. Like if it's a retail theft at a store and you want to work on retail thefts, we can sometimes have 2-3 of those calls going on at one time. So our field training officer would take the officer that they're training on that call, and they would work on making sure they obtain that information. It's not a high pressure call. It's usually the situation's over with, and it's just a matter of getting the information and then trying to track down the suspect after the fact.
Yeah. And to kind of go along with that, somebody else was wondering, how do you talk with victims who you've got an adult who's, has been under something has happened to them there, but they're under a lot of stress. Maybe they're traumatized adults. How do you talk with victims like that who are under that kind of stress?
Well, I mean, when it comes to the children, that's why we use the advocacy center. So they only have to tell their story one time if they want to. But when it comes to adults, it just comes down to being empathetic, understanding that people are when we deal with people, a lot of times it's the worst day of their life. And we have to kind of be a calming and reassuring voice and let them know that we're going to do whatever we can to help them. So it just comes down to having good people skills, understanding people, and making sure that you are empathetic to their situation.
Yeah, and along the same line, You must have to sometimes answer, or maybe you used to have, maybe not as much now. You've got really sensitive situations. How are you able to de-escalate really sensitive situations, maybe involving a couple of people?
So when we get to a scene or we're dealing with a situation where it's obviously a very sensitive situation, we want to, a lot of times if people will move together, they'll amp each other up. We'll maybe separate them, talk in a calm voice, let them know we understand their frustrations and their concerns, and that we're going to get through this, but we need everyone to calm down so we can communicate. And then it's also just kind of being straightforward with people, letting them know what you're going to do to help them and how you're going to help them and giving them options. One thing I've learned in this job is if you just tell people, well, there's nothing I can do for you, well, that's not an answer anyone wants to hear.
No.
You got to give people options. Like, hey, these are what your options are as a victim or, whatever, to these crimes.
And so then they've got some choice. So then they're looking at, okay, here are my choices. So I can, you give them a way to think that through, basically.
Yeah. And when we are in these situations that are heated at the time, we don't expect people to make rash decisions at that time. We can provide our card with the report number and say, hey, can you take some time, think about this, talk with family, friends, and then come back to us and let us know what you want to do. If it's press charges, if it's not press charges, there's all kinds of things, but we've gotten to an age in law enforcement where we got to be much more understanding of people's situations, and that when they are upset, making those decisions at that time is not the best time to just say, okay, well, they said they didn't want to press charges, or they said they want to press charges. Let's give them some time to think about it, and then call us back. We're not going anywhere. We're always around.
Okay. In the book, When I'm Dead, we interviewed the author, Hannah Morrissey, before that and before this interview. And she had talked with, and used in her book, she had talked with a detective who told her, everybody lies sometimes. And people have, the author was talking about how some people have tells or ways others can tell that they're lying. How much of that do you see in your work?
Well, unfortunately, people do lie to the police all the time. I would have to say that's a pretty true statement by the other detective. When we talk to people, we understand that immediately if they're probably not telling us everything or the truth. And that's why we got to build that rapport with them and get them to trust us. And in my best practice through the years is just be honest with people. And if you're honest with them and let them know exactly what you're thinking and where you're going with certain things, obviously without jeopardizing any sort of an investigation, they tend to be more honest and tell you more details. But even victims of crimes, unfortunately, lie to us because they might feel that they caused the situation or amped the situation up. But in the end, if we just have the truth, we can usually work through any problem. And that goes to, making sure that we have a good communication so that we're not finding out other information after the fact, and then it discredits the person we talked to.
Yeah. Do you, as a detective, have to appear in court to, when there's, some trial or something? And what do you, how does that go for you? Or what do you have to be prepared for under circumstances like that if you do it?
Yeah, that's a good question. So when we get assigned a case, we're tasked with being we are the keeper of that case, and we are in charge of everything that goes on in with the case. So a major investigation, we will typically be the first person subpoenaed for, let's say, a preliminary hearing on that case. So that would be the initial hearing to determine if there was probable cause for the district attorney's office to go to trial on the case. So we would be subpoenaed for that. And this might be getting a little too in depth, but in a preliminary hearing, we can testify to hearsay from other officers. So we would be able to testify to other officers' reports. And that, like I said, that just establishes probable cause, which is like 51% more likely that something happened than did not happen. And then if it goes to a trial, a lot of times we'll sit what they call second chair next to the prosecutor. So as the prosecutor is arguing the case in court and maybe in front of a judge or in front of a jury, we would be there to make sure they're not missing anything because we know the case, the ins and outs of the case totally. So court happens a lot. I would say I average anywhere from 5 to 20 subpoenas on my desk at any one time. So that can be very time consuming and it can be tough because some of these cases are old that we get subpoenaed for too. They can be 2, 3, even up to, I have one trial coming up that's 5 years old. So try to remember that is tough.
Oh, and that must also mean that you have to go back. Let's talk about the records you have to keep and then going back and reviewing those records before you're asked.
Yeah, and that's why we memorialize all this with good details. And that was when I was talking earlier, making sure officers take good details. Now we're in the day of body cameras, which are definitely help us because we can go back and review these body camera footage to help us, remind us what the person looked like, show us the setting, the weather that day. All that stuff helps us remember it, but writing a good detailed report definitely helps when you go to court.
Our guest, Craig Bray, Detective Craig Bray, works at the Green Bay Police Department, a busy guy, and I know there are questions for you, Craig, so we'll get to that. If you want to join in, the number to call 800-642-1234, or you can email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking about what goes on in the life of a detective. Detective work, and Craig Bray is a detective at the Green Bay Police Department. If you have questions for him about procedure or maybe something along those lines or an experience, I hope you'll join in. Number to call is 1-800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or you can email to talk@WPR.org. Do officers like the body cameras or do they think they're too invasive?
No, they like the body cameras because it shows, how people sometimes act and officers are... do they make mistakes sometimes? Of course, but 99.9% of the time, the officers are doing the right thing, and they're just trying to help, and they're just trying to do their job, and they're put in very difficult situations, and the body cam supports that every time.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You've received several awards for your work over the years. You got an award for helping the FBI with an investigation in Detroit. What was going on with that case? Or can you talk about it?
Yeah, I can talk about it. It's a closed case. It was a gentleman. This was back when I was working in the UP of Michigan, Upper Peninsula of Michigan, a small agency called Kingsford Public Safety. We had a gentleman that was from Kingsford that purchased all the materials to make a bomb at a hardware store in Iron Mountain. And he put the bomb together in Kingsford, and then he drove it to the federal building in Detroit and placed the bomb. Obviously, I don't know everything that happened down there, but the bomb sat in the building for a few days before anyone noticed it because it was in like a work bag, and they were doing construction on the building at the time. So when they figured out who had made the bomb, I was tasked with doing surveillance on the gentleman. And I had a rapport with him from working in Kingsford for several years. And my job was to just kind of make contact with him. Just like if he would be out mowing his grass or whatever, I would just go make contact so that the investigating agency, which was the Secret Service, was able to identify him. Because in a small town like Kingsford, you can't ride around with a bunch of blacked out SUVs raise a lot of attention to yourself. So they just utilized us in that we were able to communicate with this gentleman and let them know, yep, it's the guy you're looking for. And then when we went to do the arrest, I just knocked on the door and it was a very low key arrest because this gentleman had no fear of the local police because he worked with us all the time.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's interesting. And you got the Packer Protect and Serve Award. Well, tell us that story. That's pretty cool.
That's an interesting story. It was about a child who was kidnapped by his father and was missing for about 5 years. We had exhausted a lot of resources, and I was assigned the case. I don't remember when. I want to say in 2020. And it took us about 6 to 8 months working with the U.S. Marshals, and we were able to locate the child in a vehicle in Austin, Texas, not Austin, Arlington, Texas area, and reunite that child with his mother after 5 years. So that was a good experience. Unfortunately, the child had never been to like a hospital, a doctor, school in that time that the child was missing. So we were able to get the child home with mom so that the child can, you know, get the medical needs the child needed and to start the education process.
Very, very great to hear that. Ben called, couldn't stay with us. And by the way, we've had, Craig, I'll let you know, we've had a lot of calls, but we've been having some phone issues. So we've been losing people. It's like we were losing you a little bit at the beginning of the show. Ben got through, couldn't stay with us, though. How true is it that officers are allowed to lie to members of the public when they're interrogating them?
So that is a true thing. There is no crime against lying, the police lying to a suspect or a witness or whatever it may be. It's not the best practice, but it is a tool sometimes used to try and elicit information that we know someone's withholding from the police.
And how often do you have to interrogate people? TV shows make it seem very intense, and this emailer is wondering how accurate is that?
That's not accurate at all. Interviews are very low-key. They're very, they're not like you see on TV. We bring someone into an interview room. Obviously, if they're in custody, we have to read them their rights. If they're not in custody, we explain to them that you're not under arrest. You can leave at any time. You do not have to be here. And then we just start talking about the case. Now, sometimes the suspect or the person we're talking to get upset? That does happen because we ask tough questions. We have to ask the tough questions in order to, you know, figure out or try and solve the crime that we're investigating.
And to go along with that, you often see, and even the people being interrogated will say, oh, this is a good cop, bad cop kind of interview, huh? Do you use that technique ever?
I wouldn't say we use a good cop, bad cop technique, but we do find that certain suspects relate better with other detectives. Say, some suspects like talking to say a female detective. So we'll utilize a female detective to talk with that individual. Some people might have had a bad experience with that detective in the past and don't want to talk with them. So we'll utilize a different detective to talk with them. So I guess that would be the extent of good cop, bad cop, but it's not like you see on TV. It's more along the lines of like this personality fits this situation a little bit better.
Yeah. The Green Bay Police Department has something called community policing. Can you talk a bit more about that program?
Yeah, that's a very, very popular program with our department in the community. So they get assigned like districts like Adam District, Bravo District, Charlie, or David. And I don't know, I think there's two or three community police officers for each district. And they work with like landlords and businesses on just like nuisance problems. And they really get to know their community, which also helps when we get like a major crime in that area. They seem to know everybody in the neighborhood, all the businesses, and they work well with getting us some, you know, information as to who lives where, or if we need camera footage from a certain business, they have all the contacts for that. If there's landlord-tenant disputes, and it really helps clean up stuff for patrol so that they can focus on the more 911 immediate type calls.
The work you have to do, and you, as you've described it, sometimes it's got to be hard to take sometimes if there's abuse of a child or something like that. How do you keep that from your personal life?
Yeah, I mean, we do see a lot of traumatic events as law enforcement officers. The main thing you got to do is, you know, understand that you're doing the job for the right reasons. You're trying to help people who are at the lowest point in their lives, which should make you feel good internally. But outside of that, you want to surround yourself with positive people away from work. Hopefully your coworkers are positive and you can work well with them. And then when you aren't at work, you have a positive influence like with your family and stuff. So you can kind of step away from the job a little bit. But if you're doing the right things, you should feel good about your job. And understanding that we deal with people at the worst times, and it is just part of the job, but we have to just make sure that you surround yourself with good people, and it kind of all works itself out.
Do you involve yourself in the community itself, maybe even as a way to unwind, but aside from the work itself as a detective, do you get yourself involved in some ways?
I would say once in a while we do. Like, I've done a couple of events now at UWGB, University of Wisconsin-Green Bay, question and answers. They're starting up a law enforcement program. I think we're going to be bowling here coming up one of these days with the new community shelter. So we do occasional, community events. A little bit. We do that a little bit, and there's always something going on, but we have a large department and officers are always getting involved in the community.
Yeah, I would think that would be the case. Well, I tell you what, it's been a pleasure talking with you today, Craig, and it sounds like you're going to be in that job for a long, long time.
Well, I definitely have probably another 10 years to go before I can retire. But, I enjoy it. I don't want to wish away my career because I enjoy what I do.
Well, it's been great talking with you, and I really appreciate it. It sounds like Green Bay's got a good police department there, and I appreciate the work that you've done, and I hope we'll have a chance to talk again. Thanks, Craig.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Detective Craig Bray with the Green Bay Police Department. It was great to have him with us today to talk about the work that they do. And I'm sorry for the phone problems that we were having, as I know a lot of people wanted to talk and were just not able to get in. So sorry for that. And the next time we do something like this, we'll make sure that everything's working fine. Our team works pretty fine all the time, every day. Clara Neipert and Joel Patnaud are our producers for the shows. Technical directors, Jeff Robbins with me today. Lee Rayburn was with me a couple times this week as well. Our executive producer, of course, is Jill Nadeau. And you'll be hearing from Jill tomorrow, as a matter of fact, on Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.